Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 12:57 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is May 11th, and of course being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought this week I would start off and really start talking about technology. There was a lot of news in the technology sector in here today, and the Nasdaq has continued to be a leader. And when we think about the argument about whether there is in fact a secular bull market going on, well, it is being pioneered by technology. This week, Boston Technologies released another one of its very impressive videos highlighting just how impressive their robotics are. But what it does not ever show is when it shows the robot jumping or running across a field, that there is somebody walking behind it with a remote control, and that when the dog is walking up and down the stairs, it is doing so by trying to plot a route that someone has already gone through and filmed for it. So we're not talking about true autonomy. The really impressive point about Boston Dynamics is the fact that they can create these robots, that they are very graceful in negotiating their way around the human environment. But I thought that this was a very good example of enabling technologies, because when we think about what it is that's going on in terms of the market environment, well, Tesla is also one of these enabling technologies, because last week, despite the furore about Elon Musk's performance at their conference call following the earnings, the much more important statement that seems to have slipped between the rails has been the fact that they have released a battery that is an 8-to-1-to-1 nickel to manganese to cobalt ratio, and that isn't something that anyone was really expecting to happen for at least the next 7 or 8 years. And that was considered an ambitious path towards commerciality. So when we think about it in those terms, Tesla really is delivering innovation in the battery sector. And for the kinds of robots that Boston Dynamics are producing, well, the one thing that they need is power. They're not going to be much use to anybody if they have to be plugged in every 5 minutes. So their battery packs are going to be something that will require innovation in the battery sector. And we have become conditioned to expect rapid innovation in terms of technology, but the Moore's law does not really apply to batteries, because the chemistries are so much more complicated. Generally speaking, it takes about 5 years for the pace or for the energy density of batteries to double, rather than the 18-month doubling that you had in microprocessors when people were thinking about Moore's law. But again, this is an example of the fact that battery technology is one of the greatest enablers of all, that it is going to enhance the driving experience. It's going to create autonomy both for robots and for cars, because they will be less tied to a refueling network. Then you have autonomy itself. Now, there are two types of autonomy that would have to be developed for robots. One, of course, is the same kind that you have in cars. They would have to negotiate the macro human environment and avoid hitting anything or running into anything. And of course, when we also think about what the dystopian view is of the robotics sector, well, I don't think we have to take too far a leap to start thinking about automated soldiers. And Russia has already released an automated railgun, so that is certainly out there and in the works. Then, of course, you also have the micro scale, where a robot would have to negotiate inside a building. And that's something else entirely. That requires cameras. That would require the autonomous robot to make decisions about how to negotiate various different obstacles. So what that all suggests is that there's massive progress has been achieved already, but we're still quite a way from robots walking around and fulfilling tasks completely independently of humans. It also brings us to this very big question. It's something that's been animating questions from subscribers over much of the last decade, and it's one of the questions that I've been asked more than anything else. When I go around the world and give talks, one of the questions that almost always crops up is, what are we going to do when the robots take all our jobs? But last Friday, I posted this very interesting article from Quartz, and it was highlighting the fact that when we look at the figures and think about what it is that people experience out there in the world, well, it's rather different than what we see in the media. When we look at what people are saying and what their experience of out there in the world is, that factories are closing, and not so much because of automation. Generally speaking, factories don't close because of automation. They may reduce their headcount, but the robots have to work somewhere. Then why is it that factories are closing? Well, the primary reason that factories are closing is because of the simple fact that those factories are moving somewhere else. That's going to be a lower cost environment. Now, there are, classically in economics, there's two different ways of thinking about labor and labor costs. On the one hand, you can think about it that I want to have a pay rise because everyone around me is getting a pay rise, so I think I should have one too. Then there is I guess that would be the keeping up with the Joneses way of thinking about how labor is priced. Then you have the other way of thinking about it, that it is a factor of projections of future inflation, that I think my living costs are going to rise in future, so I need to get compensated for that now, so I'll be able to handle the cost of living increases. And that is generally, I think, the way that the Fed or other central banks tend to focus then on inflationary measures. But there is a third way of thinking about labor costs, and it's probably the way that the corporate sector thinks about it, and it's very simple. Labor costs are going to rise to a level at which it becomes an incontrovertible argument that we have to move the factory somewhere else to control our costs. Then that, if we start to integrate that into the way that people really experience the world, that comes a lot closer to it, doesn't it? Because when we see that we have factories that are closing and people that are getting really upset about globalization, then it's because they're either being asked to train their replacement from another country, or they are in a position where they've been working somewhere for a long time and now they're expected to move elsewhere. There's also this very classic way of thinking about the labor market, that it is almost 100% efficient, that when slack emerges in one side of the economy, that another side picks it up and that people migrate. But that's not really true. It's young people migrate and older people are left behind. It's older people have a much more difficult time of integrating into the new economy, and the pace of technological innovation is such that integrating into the newer economy is becoming progressively more difficult, not only for older people but for younger people. And what that means is that we do need to have more tools. Well, Google this week came out with a very impressive tool, and the share has bounced now from this $1,000 level. It really did need to bounce from that $1,000 level, and it has done so. But the fact that Google came through this week with this artificial intelligence, I think, assistant that can book restaurants and can make hair appointments, well, that's something that is directly contributing to productivity growth. If I don't have to spend my time doing mundane chores, then I can use it to do something more productive. This is, I think, quite far away from the realm of funny cat videos. When we think about it in those terms, people have become, I think it's a rather lazy conclusion that the evolution of social media has had no effect because we've spent a lot more time looking at pictures of each other than we have with doing just about anything else. What it has, however, contributed to is a completely new way of marketers to reach their target audience. So it has been quite a significant benefit for the corporate sector. But the kinds of things that are coming through now, where we have the innovation in the battery sector, which is revolutionary both from the perspective of transportation and energy, where we have artificial intelligence coming through, which is going to both help to alleviate mundane tasks, help to pick up some of the slack I think save time for workers, and also contribute to true autonomy for both artificial intelligence in terms of the invisible sphere, such as telephone conversations, but also for the transportation sphere. Well, these are incredible innovations that are likely to contribute to productivity growth. So when we start to think about what is it that can contribute to a secular bull market, well, we really don't have to look very far. And these are, I think, very important characteristics. Because if we go back then and think about what it is that is leading to closing of factories, well, if we look at the kinds of the kinds of countries that have got the most robots. Well, South Korea and Germany are among the, and Japan are among the countries that have got the greatest intensity of robots per factory or per worker. The USA or the UK, by contrast, is quite a bit behind them. And is it any wonder then that these are among the biggest exporters of finished goods in the world? Well, Japan right now has got a shortage of workers. And it's not just a small shortage, it's a chronic shortage of workers. And wages were breaking upwards in here this week. So we see evidence now that inflationary pressures are out there on the horizon. That's where the inflation is likely to come from. It's from wages in Japan. The Japanese labor force participation is on an upward trajectory and has been on an upward trajectory for a while. They've been working hard to integrate women into the economy because they'd previously really not been allowed to work. And that is certainly a bonus from that perspective. Certainly when we were in Japan, 6 weeks ago, what we remarked upon was the number of women that are doing really quite physical tasks, from acting as porters in hotels to changing out beer kegs and being beer delivery people. And that isn't something that you see really anywhere else. And what it does suggest is that when women are entering the workforce in Japan, they're being given a lot of the jobs that other people don't want to do. And the big question is, how quickly are they going to be able to run up the equitable table so that they are competing for exactly the same kinds of jobs that men are? So it's not just that you have a shortage of workers, but Japan does have other issues that it needs to deal with. But the reality is that that will be an inflationary outcome eventually. The question, of course, then is, what are the deflationary forces that are still keeping things under wraps? Well, the slow pace of inflation in housing is one of those. When you have got a declining workforce or declining population, then that is going to put pressure on the housing market, or it will retard its advance. But the other thing that we saw plenty of in Japan when we were there is foreign workers. We met Koreans and we met Filipinos and Chinese all working in Japan. And that is not something that I think most people are aware of, that there are plenty of people from outside Japan working in Japan, but the official line is that Japan is not friendly to immigration, whereas we see ample evidence of foreign workers in Japan, and that number is likely to grow over time. And considering that there is a shortage of workers, it's inevitable that is going to eventually be the case. But I don't think anyone is in any doubt that Japan is going to be picky about who it allows into the country to work. But again, if we think about it in these terms, that it's the most automated economies have got some of the most acute labor shortages. Well, a more automated environment does require a more educated workforce. And when we look at the kinds of companies that are delivering on the education that's required to get people upskilled, well, 2U is one of those. It's a company that goes around to universities and helps them with their online programs. Online education has been demonstrated not to be as effective as in-room or in-classroom tuition. But it may simply be a question of incentives, because a lot of the online programs don't carry recognized qualifications. What does appear to be more likely is that much more education is going to happen online, and then there will be an in-classroom component as well. That would appear to be the way that universities are going, and this remains a growth sector. So, and that's also particularly true in China, where there are a number of tuition type companies, of course there is a great deal of competition in China for higher quality education as well. Well, if it isn't technology that is leading to the closure of all of these factories, then what is it? Well, the reality is it's globalization. That when we go back and think about what was it that led everyone to jump on board GATT and the WTO, it was the hope that there was a statistic that everyone or was doing the rounds, was that when GDP got up to the region of about $4,500 to $5,500, that democracy suddenly flowered. So then there was the hope that if China was brought into the global economy, and that we traded trade and jobs, that would help their GDP to rise. And when they got up to a level of GDP growth that was in the region of $4,000 to $5,000, then democracy would flower. And instead of having a long-term adversary, we would have someone that was a more liberal democratic society. Well, it hasn't worked out like that. And that is a significant challenge now for the global economy, because China has acquired large numbers of jobs from the industrial heartlands of North America and Europe, and just about everywhere else as well, and they have no intention of losing them. They are investing heavily in automation. That Foxconn, which ticker for that. Foxconn has got a population of approximately, a workforce of 1 million people, and it's now 900,000, because they are producing robots for their own uses. Then, if we think about it in those terms, that it was globalization where corporates saw that they had the benefit of the weakness of emerging market currencies, they had the absence of environmental regulations, and they had the subsidies to build factories and very low costs of labor. So dirty and labor-intensive industries, they left, and now they are all in the emerging markets, but most particularly in China. And the hoped for flowering of democracy has not occurred. In fact, it isn't that you have to get a GDP of $4,500 to $5,500. That has subsequently been proved fallacious. That what you in fact need is for GDP to increase, but far more important for the flowering of democracy and liberalism is that you have property rights, that you have an independent judiciary, and you have an independent or free press. If you have those three conditions, then those are the preconditions for democracy to flower, because they are the inherent institutions around which a liberal society can evolve. Well, the reality is that China doesn't have any of those. And in addition to that, there is an ongoing war that is aimed not simply at freedom of expression, but also at freedom of association. And that is, I think, a very important characteristic, because what it now represents is that it is hard to make the argument that governance is improving in China. Considering that we are at a point now where this revolt against the status quo, where you have large numbers of people asking simple questions like, what about me? And the fact that you have now got a critical mass of people who are completely dissatisfied with their lot and the absence of a rise in living standards over much of the last decade, and for some even longer, that one might also conclude that it's difficult to make the conclusion that governance is improving elsewhere as well as China. Well, when we think about it again in those terms, it is this revolt against the status quo and this desire to have a fair shake that is likely to has already created this revolt against globalization, the rise of protectionism, increasing questions about universal basic income, and a demand for higher wages. All of those factors are, I think, leading from the fact that globalization has had a very clear and influential effect on the economies of lots of different countries. There have been the clear beneficiaries in the emerging markets, and then there have been the clear losers that are the lower middle class and the middle class generally of lots of OECD countries. China is engaged in this war against the freedom of association, and what they're doing is they're investing heavily in artificial intelligence. And Baidu is the primary vehicle for China's artificial intelligence. So when and that chart looks like a consolidation that is about to break out. What they are doing is they're collecting data on everyone, and we in the West, we know that Google and Facebook know our every move and where we are and what we're doing and what we're looking at. And in China, it's simply that the government has all of that information. They also know how much people are spending on their utilities and how much they're spending on electric light. And they know that people might be congregating in somebody's house, and then they're burning their they've got their lights on for longer. They know what they're posting on social media. And there will be the imposition of a social scorecard. Well, there was a news item today that, for all intents and purposes, the Los Angeles Police Department have been running a similar program where they are developing a predictive model for crime. And again, this is a very similar model. It's not that dissimilar from the Tom Cruise movie of, must be 15 years ago, Minority Report, where they were predicting what kinds of crimes people were going to do. Well, in and I guess in a democracy or in a structure where we have checks and balances, then there is the possibility to police these kinds of innovations. In a country where these innovations are being pioneered and driven by an administration that knows that every dynasty in the country's thousands of years of history has been largely overcome by peasant revolts, then they have twice as many domestic political or domestic security operatives as they do soldiers. So China is investing heavily in combating any risk of civil war. The question is, what is going to happen when China eventually imposes a property tax? That has been delayed this year, but it's probably going to come through next year. The land sales model that the regions have been employing for much of the last 30 to 40 years is unsustainable, and it creates too much leverage and an over-reliance on property and infrastructure. The imposition of a property tax would help to correct the finances of the regions and the cities, so it makes logical sense. But of course, it will also put a tax on the ability of people to hold on to large property portfolios at no cost. And that is, I think, a significant issue. The Shanghai Property Index is now underperforming. At the same time, the H-share index is bouncing from this 12,000-point level, and it's beginning to demonstrate support in the region of the trend mean. If we get upside follow-through next week, well, I think then we can begin to conclude that we've seen a low of more than short-term significance. When we look at the NASDAQ, it is not so far away now from that psychological 7,000 area where it has paused on two separate occasions over so far this year. I think anyone can see that there is still this progression of higher reaction lows. And despite the fact that we have had an uptick in volatility, and most particularly compared to that very persistent advance we saw in 2017, as long as that progression of higher reaction lows is intact, the vast majority of people are not going to be particularly worried about it. Then when we look at the Russell 2000, it is back above the 1600-point level, and it is only 9 points away from a new all-time high. This was a relatively modest pullback, and it also has this clear upward bias. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had a clear acceleration at the end of last year, but it too is also steadying in here, and this was a very positive week. We've had a pretty impressive rebound over the last 2 weeks from the region of the trend mean, and now it is pressuring that 25,000-point level once more. It's not, I suppose, particularly unlikely that there was going to be some pause around a psychological level like 25,000, but again, as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean, then I think we can conclude that this is a corrective phase within a still impressive medium-term bull market. Now, there are questions that people have been asking about whether this is a peak or the peak, and I think the most important characteristic is to look at when are we going to have the next recession. Because whenever that recession comes, then it's going to contribute to a pullback of somewhere in the order of 20 to 30%. I do not believe that we're going to have the kind of pullbacks that we saw in 2008 and indeed in 2000. And part of the reason for that is because when we look at long-term ratios like the Dow Gold Ratio, we can see the cyclicality that we have in these very long-term charts. And we know that there are approximately 35 years between the peaks. So the last peak was in 1999, and the next peak, which generally coincide with the peaks in secular bull markets on Wall Street is probably not going to be until sometime in the early 2030s. If that is indeed the case, then we know that no bull market proceeds without the occasional pullback, and the next recession will provide one of those pullbacks. In a secular bull market, those pullbacks are some of the most attractive buying opportunities that we can anticipate. So it is really only a question of when is the next, I think, recession likely to come. Well, when we look at, for example, high yield spreads, they are completely inert. And generally speaking, they tend to really start to trend higher a few months before we have any real fear of a recession, and they are not trending higher. If we look at the yield curve spread, it's not really until it becomes inverted that it gives us a lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months before the next recession. Well, it's at 43 basis points, and it is trending lower, but it is not negative. Unemployment was at a new low this week or last week. It hasn't been this low since 2000. Well, you don't really have a recession until people start losing their jobs. So that's not going to be a particularly timely indicator, considering that it's not updated every day, whereas the bond markets are. Then the one question that is the question mark about the next recession is the oil market, because oil prices are now at $77 on Brent, and the pace of the advance is picking up. This is not the same kind of surge in oil prices yet that we had in 2007 or 2008, but we know that the price is going up, and it has not stopped going up just yet. I think that $100 is going to be a bit of a psychological level, but it really has to go quite a ways to get there. And a lot of the reason that it is going up is geopolitical. That you have had the sanctions or the US has reimposed sanctions on Iran, and that's going to have repercussions for any companies that do business in the USA that also do business with Iran. Then you have the fact that Saudi Arabia and Russia and OPEC generally have reduced their production. So that is contributing to this backwardation that we have in the oil markets, and it's continuing to rally from here. But it's not simply that we have this bullish environment in the energy complex, where Royal Dutch Shell has cruised through to new all-time highs this week. And this is the completion of a very long-term range for the share. When we look at the industrial metals complex generally, and I'm just looking at the BlackRock World Mining Trust, it does look like it is in the process of completing a more than year-long range. Then when we look at the grains complex, and I tend to look at the ETFS grains index, because this is compiled by futures, it does tend to have a downward bias when prices go sideways because of the contango costs. But it is now above the trend mean and spending more time above the trend mean than any time since 2014. And there is the prospect that we do get some additional upside in the grains complex. When we think about what the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been saying, they released a report yesterday saying that they were anticipating that yields for soy, wheat, and corn would be lower this year for the first time in a few years, and they're putting that down to weather events, particularly in the spring. And we also know that when something has been trending lower for 5 years already, that supply will start to get taken out of the market. So it does then become rather acutely sensitive to the weather events. And There was also a news item I saw at some point this week that storms would appear to be gaining intensity faster, and that is potentially because of warmer weather conditions. So, putting these things together, we can see that there is this recovery going on in the resources sector, and the continuous commodity index is in the process of breaking up out of what is almost a full 2 year process of consolidation. And CPI came in this week a little bit lower than people might have been anticipating, but 10-year TIPS have been ranging for 5 years, and they're right in the region of the upper side of that range. So what that suggests to me is that there is at least somebody beginning to price in an inflationary outcome. One reason, before I move on to US Treasuries, one reason I think it is interesting to look at TIPS is because there's no new additional supply planned. That the US government has got to fund the rolling over of a lot of 10-year maturity debt that was taken out in 2008 and subsequently. So that's a significant amount of additional supply. Then you have the additional supply as a result of the fiscal stimulus. So that's another big wad of additional supply coming into the bond markets. But it's all going to be in the treasury markets. There isn't any additional supply planned for the TIPS markets. So if we do see yields pushing up here, we can conclude that it is not because of lots of additional new supply coming into the market, but rather it's going up for a different reason. And considering that these are Treasury inflation protected securities, we might conclude that it's an inflationary reason. 10-year Treasuries have been pausing around the 3% level. They were very briefly back above 3% on the yield this week. But on this weekly chart, we can see just how tight this consolidation around 3% has been. It's slowly but surely allowing the 200-day moving average to catch up with the yield. And that is going to be that's going to take a while longer if that oversold condition for the price is going to be unwound. But this is a lengthy base formation, and prices have been going sideways already for 5 years. If we start to see yields pushing up above 3%, well, then I think we will have some evidence that we're back in a supply-dominated environment, and not just for the short term, but probably for the medium term. We start to see yields above 4%, and then we can very clearly say that the trend has been broken. But I think it is more correct to look at this market on a total return basis. And when we look at the total return on Treasury futures, if you were to roll them over, it was the best possible trade in the world from 1981 until about 2016, because all you had to do was buy the dips and you always made money. Well, that's changed. There has been a complete loss of momentum, and we've now got a lower high and we've got lower lows. And if that's the case, we have to at least consider the potential that this is an evolving Type 3 top formation, which we define as ranging time and size. And the neckline on that top does look to be somewhere around 2050. And what that suggests, and considering that 3% is the corresponding level that we have on yields, if it does break below 2050, then we can already start to conclude that a Type 3 top has been completed, and that we are now in a secular bear market for yields. Now, we're getting all of these challenges to the status quo. People that are worried about their standard of living. And the way I tend to think about this is in terms of crowd psychology. I suppose that's not such a big surprise. But if we think about crowds, they tend to be animated by a a very clear reason. There has to be a clear, cohesive reason for people to join a crowd. And if you're in a community that was characterized by an industry and probably by religion and probably by race, then when the industry disappears, well, the fallback for the community is to fall back on the other two animating forces for the crowd. When they're looking at the community and lots of people value their community and the industry disappears, well, then they fall back on religion and they fall back on race relations or their identity. And, well, religion has been declining in popularity right around the developed world. So then what that contributes to is the potential for a refocus on race to become an issue. And we've seen the way that that works out is in terms of nationalism. It's anti-immigrant, and then it becomes populist. But what it all contributes to is a reversion in terms of the discourse, that emotionality tends to take over when people are in dire straits. And when people have lost the industry on which their livelihoods depended and the health of their communities depended, well, it's not an exaggeration to say that they're in dire straits. So that is contributing to this uptick in populism, which is variously described as xenophobic or nationalist or anti-immigrant or racist. And it's also contributing to the rise of the Me Too campaign, or indeed to Black Lives Matter. So there are certainly two ways of thinking about it. Some people who are more oriented towards socialism will obviously start to express their frustrations in one way, and those that are more focused on free markets and capitalism will start to express themselves in another way. But they're both, I think, victims of globalization and this status quo that benefited from the situation that's existed for much of the last 40 years. What is also interesting is when we look at the long-term charts for U.S. treasuries, and Shiller's long-term treasury rates are rather interesting, because the big run-up in yields started in 1940 and ended in 1980. Then we have had a declining yield environment from 1980 to approximately 2018. So 40 years versus 28 years. Well, the big decline in yields from 1920 to 1940 was only 20 years. The big uptick was only 20 years. So we might conclude that that cycle was a short cycle, and the cycle we've had since is a long cycle. But then if we look at approximately going back to the 1770s, yields had contracted all the way to 1900, which is not far off the 40-year mark either. So we can conclude from this very long-term chart of yields that 40 years is about the length of time that you get in terms of an interest rate cycle. It's not far off the Kondratiev wave estimate. But if we are at the end of the pattern of lower yields, well, then we're approaching the period of higher yields. And this is rather important, because we're getting this rise in this revolt against globalization. And that is inflationary. If we get a rise in protectionism, we get demands for higher wages or for living wages or for money being dropped from the heavens so that people just want to have more money, well, that is inherently inflationary. So on the one hand, we have technological innovation, and the pace of technological innovation is advancing rapidly. And it is being embraced by an increasingly large number of countries as well as companies. And that's likely to be both a deflationary and inflationary force over time. A revolt against globalization, however, is inherently inflationary. And if we are at an environment now where we have low yields, well, then we should be looking at the kinds of shares that can raise those dividends. Because, for example, the Consumer Staples Index was being bought from 2009 for two reasons. One was leverage to the global consumer, and two was because it has yield, it has bond-like characteristics because of the sustainability of those dividends. Well, you had yield compression because yields were so very low. Well, now you're getting yield expansion, and that is contributing to this decline in prices. The kinds of companies that do best in an inflationary environment are those that can grow really fast, so that they can outpace inflation. Then there are the companies that have pricing power, that they can raise their prices faster than inflation rises, and that way they can hold on to their margins. Well, the consumer staples sector is going to have to be able to demonstrate one or both of those characteristics in order to arrest the yield expansion that is going on right now. This is a quite considerable lack of uptrend consistency. Then in the technology sector itself, you've had the adoption of the subscription business model. And this is creating bond-like reliability in cash flows from high-growth companies. So if we're thinking about it in those terms, then it is primarily within the technology sector that we are seeing evidence of these kinds of characteristics that will benefit from an inflationary environment. And that is perhaps an additional reason why they continue to exhibit relative strength. So I think that's another important characteristic. If we think about it in the long term, the potential is that we are now in a multipolar world. We're only at the dawn of a revolt against the status quo and globalization generally. We're only at the dawn of an inflationary cycle, but technological innovation has been going on for a long time. And there is increasing, because we're in a multipolar world, then there is competition in terms of who can come up with technology and commercialize technology fastest. The major news item about AI today was that artificial intelligence companies were at the White House and getting pats on the back. But Intel, for example, was saying that other countries have got a top-down, very organized way of implementing artificial intelligence, and that the USA in particular needs to come up with a joined up way of thinking if they're going to succeed in holding on to their edge. So I think that the argument for the evolution of a multipolar world where you have the USA at one end and China at the other, and a competition between the two for influence with the other big population countries where we have emerging markets, not least India and Indonesia, and most of Africa. That is where the competition of the future is likely to rest. And we will have a recession at some point. But the fact is that if we have technological innovation and we have a business model that is likely to benefit from inflation, and we have inflation, then these are all contributors to a secular bull market in nominal pricing. And it will be punctuated occasionally by the odd recession, and those will be buying opportunities for at least the next 10 to 15 years, at which point we can anticipate that there will be another very significant, disruptive pullback, but probably not until the 2030s. The rise of government bond yields is going to be a significant headwind to bond investors. And the inability of total return bond managers to deliver a positive return over the course of the last few years is a testament to just how difficult this market is. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and for the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.